Welcome to Clarity Lab, where I talk to leading health and science experts to educate, inform, and dismantle misinformation. And if you are a human on this planet in 2025, you probably know what a problem misinformation is. I'm Derek Barris, and Clarity Lab is the official podcast of Cyrus Health, a 501c3 nonprofit I founded to build a free educational platform and curate social media channels that feature experts presenting health and science in a clear and compelling manner. And since we are a nonprofit, all your donations are tax deductible, which helps support our mission. Please visit cyrushealth.org to learn about what we're doing and what we plan to do in the future. And if you can support us, we would greatly appreciate it. What if Maha could do something really good for America? What would that actually look like? Kevin Klatt has an idea. Fund clinical nutrition studies. As Kevin wrote in a recent article, clinical nutrition has been woefully underfunded for over a generation. And we all know how much wellness influencers love to talk about nutrition, but with their products, they usually don't have the research. So let's do the research. You have to realize that every time you see a wellness influencer talking about the impact of some food or supplement on the microbiome, they're just making that up. And if RFK Jr. really cared about food and health, he could actually change that. So after I read the article, I was really glad Kevin wanted to chat. Kevin Klatt is an assistant research scientist and instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Sciences, and Toxicology at UC Berkeley. He received his PhD in molecular nutrition from Cornell University and completed his dietetic internship at the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center. This is the last episode of season one of Clarity Lab. I don't want to say that I saved the best for last because I've really enjoyed all these conversations, but this is a good one. Kevin, I wanted to talk to you about your article that I loved. Maha could do something truly radical and good. And you start out by pointing out that understanding whether or not food dyes cause hyperactivity in children relies on nutrition funding for research and infrastructure. And this is an angle I don't hear ever from wellness influencers. They invent conspiracies about the lack of funding for supplements, for example. But you're talking about something very different here. So I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to write this article?
One, thanks for having me on. Two, as I look at my own career, I have spent about half of my time in more basic science and half of my time in more clinical trials. And as I continue on, you know, it's hard to do a bit of everything. And so I would love to focus a lot more on clinical trials, but I have sort of spent a lot of time scouring pretty much everything I can about the history of funding of research, especially, you know, nutrition and non-pharmaceutical interventions in the United States. And it's a pretty sad history. And in the past 20 years, the funding has only gotten worse. And I know a bunch of like top people in nutrition, NIH level major institutions. And I've just gone to them and been like, am I wrong for thinking that this money just seems to not exist? Like, I did my training at Cornell in human and molecular nutrition, clinical trials there, trained as an RD in a research setting, and I've made it work to do some intervention trials, but it just seems like such an uphill battle and something about that doesn't make sense to me. And so I wanted to kind of lay this out there that I don't think a lot of people know, even though it's like kind of quietly talked about broadly in the fields of physiology, metabolism, nutrition, that doing anything in humans that is experimental or even observational, that is anything that requires drawing blood or taking a biopsy in a sort of a controlled setting, that type of research that we used to have somewhat of an infrastructure for has really been defunded by basically Francis Collins in the 2010 to 2015 era, but really started in 2006. So we're coming up on 20 years of basically just like really hampered to minimal funding. And I think folks have probably seen in the headlines that, like, you know, it's all now avocados and walnuts and beef and eggs. And some of that's because of observational literature, but a lot of that is because it's commodity boards that for those industries that have stepped up to start kind of funding the research that used to be in part funded by the government. But all of the really classic old literature on, like, that we have pretty good data on how does diet affect blood or how does fat composition affect blood cholesterol? How does sodium affect blood pressure? If you care about new questions like how does diet affect the microbiome, we are much less able to answer that confidently now in our modern research infrastructure than we were 25 years ago, which I think is sad. There's been a regression. And a lot of my peers who trained in doing controlled nutrition intervention studies also don't see a career in this. I don't really see a career in this. And are leaving and going off to industry jobs and things because it's just, I mean, we all know research funding is an uphill battle, but there's a point at which it becomes like, if you can't pay the mortgage, don't buy the house. And why would I go start a lab and trying to do this kind of stuff when the money's just not there? So this was like my sort of plea that, as more and more people talk about wellness, it's sort of like this collective gaslighting for people who work in this field to be trying to beg for pennies. And then you turn on the internet or you walk through a supplement store and there's billions upon billions of dollars in this marketplace, and not even like a small fraction of that gets translated into research. And then everybody wants to, evidence, quote unquote, evidence-based products. And it's like, well, yeah, we're not going to have that if we don't even have the infrastructure to do it. So that post was really just to put out my own sort of frustrations and, put what people have been writing in the literature. I cited in that article, there's two kind of dramatized titles in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, as well as the American Diabetes Association Journal. And they're called the Eulogies for the Clinical Investigator and the Eulogy for the Metabolic Clinical Investigator. This is back in 2016, so almost 10 years ago, where they're literally saying, like, with the defunding of this older general clinical research center network and the replacement that the NIH put in place, it's just the death of those fields of clinical investigation. Everything about endocrinology, metabolism, nutrition has really, we've seen it come to not a complete halt. People are still trying to piece things together. There's many ways that we try and understand things in nutrition, but controlled feeding interventions are one of them. If you can't feed people things, it's really hard to understand the effect of diet on health outcomes. And right now, it's just very hard to feed people things and get funding for that.
And you mentioned the microbiome there, which all these problems that you're bringing up, it opens the door for wellness influencers to come and use things like animal models or speculation or in vitro models to say, oh, this is going to do this in your body too. Buy my supplements, which will actually help accomplish this.
I work in animal model research and like to do that translation of how do we go from petri dish to animals and then into humans. And that capacity to translate that is so limited. And I think there is this collective sense of frustration. Oh, it's so hard to know anything in humans and so hard to study it. So I'm just going to buy my supplement based off of like animal data because that's quote unquote good enough. And I think that's a sad kind of apathy that just feeds into this putting the burden on the consumer to decide whether something works, which really lines the pockets of supplement industry and wellness influencers and everybody with a hashtag ad. And really the science becomes a small part of that, which I think is true in a lot of this stuff. It becomes more of a wellness ritual than it is about science. But for somebody coming at it trying to do research on things and understand what works and how do we help patients and how do we improve health outcomes, it's a sad state of things.
And you bring up all of the moving pieces that are involved in trials like what you're expressing that you want funding for. So you have staffing, research grade kitchen equipment, data analysts to look at the blood. Can you sort of lead the listeners through what it would actually take to accomplish this level of research to be confident in making assessments about nutrition?
I can describe the way it's been done. And I think a lot of folks argue that needs to be scaled up because it's largely, you have sort of a metabolic unit is the sort of ideal. So you have the ability to draw blood, process blood samples, potentially have overnight beds where people would stay. So you have this mini little clinic basically that exists. So I did my PhD at Cornell and we had one there. It's like a few pretty large rooms. Like it was like a wing of a building essentially kind of hidden away. But you had, a nurse practitioner who staffed it with other phlebotomists around. You had a big DEXA machine, which these are very, very expensive, but to do like body composition type stuff. So you'd want to have everything to sort of assess the metabolic state of an individual, everything about their anthropometrics, so their body weight, body composition. You'd want to be able to obviously take height and weight, and then you'd want to be able to draw their blood. In more advanced settings, you'd want to be able to take a biopsy. So if you're trying to understand actually how diet affects what's happening at the tissue level, you'd want to be able to like take an adipose biopsy or a muscle biopsy. You'd want to be able to like collect people's urine and fecal samples and process these. And so you have to have dedicated space for that because those are not clean things. And then obviously, if you're going to be feeding somebody, you need something of a metabolic kitchen nearby. So this isn't like a regular kitchen so much as every single thing is weighed out on a gram scale in its raw form and then in its cooked form. So to prepare a recipe takes a whole lot longer. You need trained staff who are able to do that so that when you say you fed 100 grams of cooked spinach to somebody, that's actually 100 grams of cooked spinach, because all that variation matters. So you really have to have like deep, deep control of everything in the environment. And so you can imagine just the cost of having a wing of a building with expensive equipment, people who are really highly trained. And that's just to get to the point where you get the samples that you want. And then you have to go start sending them off for analyses, whether that's measuring metabolites or sequencing the microbiome or sequencing all the RNAs in their cell to get a feel of how diet is affecting every level of what we can make inferences about health on. And then you need statistical expertise and analysts to do a lot of this. You can imagine you need a lab manager, study manager, people to operate the machinery. That sort of infrastructure and personnel is quite expensive. And you would need all that to answer every single claim you see on a supplement saying like, oh, it influences inflammation and it boosts your microbiome and all these sorts of things. That would be like a several million dollar studies each probably to test those claims. And that's why you don't see these human trials. I'm not arguing that we should go test every claim that every supplement makes. But for the really high impact, like scientifically valid sort of things, like some of the work that I tried to do in my PhD was looking at nutrient requirements during pregnancy that affects infant brain development. These were huge, expensive studies. And I was like a grad student working 80 to 90 hours a week, obviously not getting compensated like you might hope, just to push these sort of things forward. And these studies go on for years and years and years. Like when you do a pregnancy study, we pass off the infants in our trial to human development colleagues who study them for the next 10 years or whatever afterwards to do cognitive assessments on them. So you need continuous secure funding to be able to do this research in the really rigorous way that you want to. The fluxes in funding that can occur and infrastructure coming and going is really bad for science, because you want researchers to be able to keep at this, not worried about how they're going to keep the lights on, and if anything, be able to expand and do more good stuff.
Now, you write that previous research, when it was more funded, bore fruit and you made progress in these fields. What are some examples that you came across that really made a difference in our understanding of nutrition?
In the sort of middle of the 20th century, there was this kind of shift away from infectious diseases, and people got really interested in cardiovascular disease in particular. You see the start to the Framingham study, which is one of the big longitudinal cohorts. And you start to identify body weight, blood pressure, blood cholesterol as risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And while you have drug development happening there, you also had a huge network of nutrition researchers who were studying all the different ways that diet could influence things like blood cholesterol. And so we have a diet compared to drugs is much harder to study. You don't have a placebo. I don't get to give you a placebo pill versus a statin. If I give you a bunch of saturated fat, I have to give you some other isocaloric comparator, so the same amount of a different type of fat. Otherwise, if I feed you a bunch of saturated fat without having a comparator, I am going to just increase your weight at the same time. And that confounds the whole experiment. You have to wonder, is it the saturated fat or is it the weight gain and hypercaloric feeding that did it? And so you then have to come into, okay, so you need one comparator that's like a monounsaturated fat. And then you have another comparator that's a polyunsaturated fat. And actually, there's different types of polys. You have trans fats. And so you get like these 5-6 arm studies that you would need to start to answer with all the pairwise comparisons to get a feel for what types of fats are impacting blood cholesterol. And we have hundreds of controlled metabolic ward studies from this kind of 30, 40 year era, where we very readily can predict with equations and have great meta-analyses of controlled trials. For a 1% energy, you know, 1% of calorie change, how if you replace saturates with monos or saturates with carbs or saturates with polyunsaturated fats, what's going to happen to blood cholesterol? And they're pretty accurate and predictive. That's part of why whenever you hear about dietary guidelines, like we still highly recommend replacement of saturated fat with unsaturated fat sources. And we have that really rigorous controlled data to rely upon saying like, quite confident that's going to lower LDL cholesterol. And that sort of fanfare around cardiovascular disease at the time, you know, really the nutrition world benefited from that and had the infrastructure to do this sort of work. We are not in that same sort of era where you've got a network of metabolic kitchens and metabolic units across the country where the same thing could be said for the microbiome. Do we have any level of confidence about individual dietary components or total dietary patterns on microbiome composition, function, like we do with blood cholesterol, blood pressure? Not even close. And we're like not on a trajectory of producing that kind of data where we'll have any level of confidence that we have in sort of more basic things. So I would say the cardiovascular disease nutrition space is where we have by far the most data. And it's not just, you know, controlled metabolic studies. Like, I want to shout out my epidemiologist friends here. There's that, you know, nutrition has to triangulate across multiple types of evidence, I think, to really be super confident. But that controlled metabolic studies are really a key portion of it. And with less funding to do that kind of work, you just have less and less confidence in the nutrition recommendations that are going to come out. So you see lots of people being like, nutrition is the way, pharma is bad or whatever. And it's like, well, pharma is funding phase 1, 2, and 3 randomized controlled trials with tens of thousands of people in them studying the effects of drugs on hard endpoints. Nutrition already really struggles, obviously, to feed people things for 5 years and with 10,000 people in it. The evidence is always intrinsically a little bit weaker in nutrition. But if you want to get to the peak of what we can say, you need to invest in epidemiological research, controlled feeding studies, and we have large cohorts that you can readily mine and go back to and measure new things. But I would say the ability to intervene and do feeding studies, randomized controlled trials, pretty tough out there.
Mark Hyman has said that 90% of diseases can be attributed to the microbiome through the leaky gut. Are you saying that his evidence isn't quite there?
Oh, God. Every time I think of Mark Hyman, I just think of my checking account and I go, gosh, I've made so many mistakes in life.
Well, let's reframe that, because food and nutrition has long felt like something that unqualified people who have never actually gone to school to be a dietitian or for nutrition feel qualified to talk about. More than anything else, I think, in the decade plus that I've been covering health misinformation. Why do you think that is?
You know, a lot of people say it's because everybody eats and everybody has an opinion. And I think that's obviously a component of it, but it's not gatekept behind a prescription pad. There's already a popular belief. Like, it's very, I think people kind of intrinsically, you go back in every single society that anthropologists have ever studied, and people have, you know, taboos and mores and just sort of beliefs about health or food's impact on health. Some of it is probably very real. Like, you know, many, many, many cultures believed that liver of animal cured night blindness, and liver of animal is like a rich source of vitamin A, and vitamin A deficiency presents with night blindness pretty early on. And so, like, humans have always been trying to link food to health. And so there's this kind of desire to want to comment on it, sort of have a quick, easy fix of just change your diet and cure everything about your health. So I think there are some folks who are like, there's a human nature and some level of altruism to it. But I think a lot of it is just also like in the kind of modern environment, is you can, not even modern environment, you can go back to like 1920s and 30s when some of the first writings about nutrition recommendations were happening, a lot of it from like USDA farmers bulletins and things. You can see people warning about charlatans selling cleanses and giving stimulants to lose weight and all of this kind of stuff. And so snake oil is really like at the heart of American culture. It goes back to the beginning. Now in a modern kind of wellness environment where everybody can have an ad and sort of a kickback coupon code and things, it's a great way to make money. And, you know, you don't need to know the data at all to profit off of it. If I'd, you know, had a dollar for every time I woke up and a physician launched their new supplement or their new ad code or whatever, I'm sure they're swimming in $500,000 of debt from medical school and feel hopeless. And I'm not like trying to judge them per se, but the collective is a really sad state of things where the consumer just has to wade through this insane amount of claims and noise with zero scientific training, and are being told things by people with zero scientific training. And there's really no enforcement or regulation on these things until it gets like egregiously bad. And it's almost always really big companies who play by the rules, obviously, a bunch more than, because they're more visible than the sort of everyday wellness influencer. So feels like something of an insurmountable problem. But I guess like most things in America, money is probably the biggest driver of this kind of stuff. And even if it doesn't seem like it's about money, most people are trying to build a brand, which is ultimately going to line their pocketbook in some way. So I see people promoting supplements that they don't have like an immediate link to, but it's just they're curating an image online as being perceived like an expert in sort of healing in general, and supplements are the obviously non-prescription pad gatekept way to do that.
Last question, another sort of cultural question, but I think it's very pertinent right now. About a decade ago, you had Michael Bloomberg trying to implement a soda tax in New York City, got a ton of pushback across the board, but specifically right-wing media. Michelle Obama tried to reduce sodium in schools. You wrote about that. You know, again, hammered by right-wing media. Yet they're all on board with RFK Jr. and MAHA, at least most of them are. Why do you think that there's this strange coalition between certain media angles or outlets, and then the wellness influencers have all coalesced around this movement.
Oh gosh, there's a lot there to unpack. Anytime I try and get into the mind of other people who I don't agree with, it gets a little scary. You know, I think people have an amnesia. Like, I don't think most of the people who are jumping on the MAHA train remember that the same news outlets 8 years ago were calling Michelle Obama the food police. I also think there's something, an element of this that sort of in the popular just general culture, going back to like the food babe and things in like 2010, the chemicals in food, get the chemicals out of food sort of like mantra is there. And Michelle Obama's type work was like really, I would say, more evidence-based. Like, you know, food dyes, there's lots of claims going on now that they're like going to cause cancer and that they're like awful for hyperactivity in kids and things, like pretty extravagant claims that the data don't fully back up. Michelle Obama was like trying to get less sodium in schools, lunches for kids to help with blood pressure control and things. It's shifting the diet towards something that looks more like the USDA dietary guidelines, which I think one of these feels quite establishment, and there's quite a big anti-establishment kind of vibe there right now in politics, and sort of just to blow it all up and get the chemicals out of our food and all this kind of stuff. And so I think the messaging is really key here, that they might on the face both look like people trying to change the food system, but one comes with vibes that are much more like explode the system. Corporations are poisoning us with what they put in, with the chemicals they put into food, and get them out. And banning a food dye kind of like really riles that up. Whereas like reducing the amount of sodium progressively over time in school lunches while you increase the fiber and whole grain content and reduce the saturated fat and things sounds like, oh, that's establishment stuff that the people have been saying since the 80s. So it doesn't really have that kind of like sex appeal to it.
Actually, last question now. I want to leave on something instructive. You already flagged that we just see so many claims and so much information online. For the casual consumer who's just trying to live a healthy life, what would you recommend they do if they see a food claim on social media and they don't really have the wherewithal to assess whether or not it has any validity?
I think it's 2025. If you're not a cynic who thinks that people are lying to you about health and trying to make money off of you, that I'm not sure you'll ever change. But I think that's sort of just the mindset you have to go into and really have a clear head about things. You know, when you are looking at an individual product, try and remember that every single day you turn on Instagram, there's going to be a new product that also has the same type of claims. And if you were to actually like sort of in the moment get caught up every single time that you saw a product that made a claim about, oh, it's going to give you energy, do you feel exhausted, all this kind of stuff, my supplement can fix that, you would spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a month because every single product is making all these same claims. So don't get caught in the isolated moment with the add to cart kind of appeal because someone validated the fact that you feel stressed and that things are not feeling great right now. Because that's like classic communication 101, that you have to build trust with a consumer and then you can sell them anything. And so you're going to see almost everything that's making that inroad of, we all know we live in a toxic environment, we're all stressed, all this kind of stuff, our microbiomes are messed up. Every single product says this. And then they just sell you a product with no data actually backing up that it supports any of those things. So just be really skeptical of things that you might use, very non-specific symptoms that people are talking about that their product is supposedly the answer for, because there's literally thousands of products out there. And if you are going to pursue one of them, I would say like be clear-headed about it, set up your own little type of N of one experiment where you're like, I'm going to try this for 2 months. I'm going to journal my symptoms. I'm going to go off of it, journal my symptoms. I'm going to go back on it, journal my symptoms, and really try to like objectively figure out if this is something worthwhile. And obviously talk to your medical practitioner if you can, make sure it's not something objectively harmful, but try and think a bit, I think, like a scientist about these things. I'm not trying to like tell people to never buy anything and never try anything. Some people really do have real symptoms that they want to test whether something worked for, but going in and being clear-headed about like, this product has no more data than the 999 other products that I'm going to get an Instagram ad for the moment I Google supplements or whatever. We do not live in a world where any of these products, for the most part, go through any sort of phase 1, 2, 3 type testing like a drug does. They have to prove safety and efficacy. And so it is really on the consumer to decide whether something works. That's how America is right now. And so be cautious, be a little cynical, and be clear-headed if you are going to purchase something.